Thank you. My name is James Menyuk. I'm a trustee of the council. And on behalf of the council, I'm delighted to be able to welcome Dambisa to this forum. It's actually a particularly tremendous pleasure for me personally, given that we have so many other different connections from university and the part of the world we all have a connection to, which is Southern Africa. Dambisa is the author of the New York Times bestseller, Dead Aid, and How the West Was Lost. In 2009, Dr. Moyo was named by Time Magazine as one of the 100 most influential people in the world. Her work regularly appears in economic and finance-related publications, such as the Financial Times, The Economist magazine, and The Wall Street Journal. Dambisa holds a doctorate in economics from Oxford University and a master's degree from Harvard. She also was a senior economist at Goldman Sachs. And it's also a great delight to be able to mention that her current book that she's going to talk about today just got onto the New York Times bestsellers list. I think it's number 13 or something like that. So we're very impressed by that. So ladies and gentlemen, please help me in welcoming Dambisa as she talks about the role of China in the world. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thank you, James. Thank you very much to all of you for being here on a Friday afternoon, nonetheless, which is also lunchtime. But it's a pleasure to be here, and I must say, I say this in every audience, but it's a very odd experience sitting around and hearing people talk about your biography, because it does feel like it's your wake, and you're sort of not being seen in your own funeral. But in any case, it's wonderful to be in San Francisco again. So today's conversation is about China's race for resources and what it means for the world. And what I would like to do, if you'll permit me, is to spend about sort of 30 minutes, 35 minutes, talking to you about what I see as the biggest challenge that the world will be facing over the next decade, which is the scarcity of resources. In order to do that, I have separated the conversation into three parts. First of all, I would like to set the context of this race for resources. And by that, I mean I'd like to lay out for you the demand pressures that the world is facing right now in terms of commodities, and also talk a little bit about the supply availability of land, water, energy, and minerals, and how that imbalance is shaping up. I'd then like to spend some time talking specifically about the demand and supply dynamics that are specific to China. So what pressures are driving China, and also what challenges she has in terms of supply of these resources to her own population. And then finally, I would like to spend some time talking about specifically China's approach in securing resources around the world. And I'll be talking about what I call a three-pronged approach to securing those resources. And as part of that discussion, I'll wind up with a conversation about some of the more controversial aspects of China's campaign for resources. As you, I'm sure, are familiar, if you read the papers, there are lots of charges and claims that China is basically embarking on neocolonialism, issues around the use of prisoners as labor, concerns about labor and environmental rights being violated. So we'll talk a little bit about that, and then we'll have some time for Q&A. And I hope you'll be very engaged, because there's nothing worse for an author than to stand up, speak, and then not have any questions. So please start filling out questions as soon as possible. So first of all, let's talk about global demand. There are three key factors that are driving global demand for resources. And I'd like to start off by just talking about first one, which is something that we talk about a lot in economics, and this is the growth of the world's population. As people are aware in this room, there are now about 7 billion people on the planet. The expectations are that by 2050, there will be 9 billion people on the planet, and as many as 10 billion by 2100. Now, what I really want to emphasize here is that we are living in a very, very unique time in the history of the world. This is a period where the population of the world has skyrocketed over the last several decades. And many demographers believe that it was never seen in prehistory, and it will never be seen again once the population plateaus out. And we think by 2075, 2100, once the population gets to about 10 billion, we will not continue to see this exponential growth. If you will permit me, I'd just love to read a statement that has been made by a demographer and a sociologist, John Durant, back in 1966. Just for your information, sort of 1950s, the world population was around 3 billion. So you can imagine just certainly in my lifetime, the population has gone from 3 billion to around 7 billion. But let me read for you what he said. He says, the extraordinary proliferation of the human species cannot fail to be recognized as one of the principal features of the modern world history. In historical perspective, it appears as a unique episode in the growth of the species since its origin. It has no parallel in the history, prehistory of the world for the speed and magnitude of the expansion of numbers. And it seems highly unlikely that a comparable expansion would occur again in the future after the present trend has run its course. I read this to really underscore the fact that we are living in a very unique time. And we'll talk about Malthus and some of the projections, previous projections from places like the Club of Rome and Thomas Malthus in decades gone by, who were raising alarms around resource scarcity. But they hadn't, at that time, had no thought or they had no context to understand that the population would be as big as it is today, but also growing as rapidly as it is today. So population, number one, is a big problem, a big driver in terms of commodity demand. The second big driver of commodity demand is population wealth. The world is becoming richer, and 88% of the world's population lives in the emerging world, and that's precisely where we're seeing massive increases in the world's population getting much richer. Expectations are that we will have approximately 3 billion new people in the world's middle class by 2030, which is not too far away. And a lot of those people will be coming from not just Asia, but also Africa and parts of Eastern Europe and South America. So significant improvements in wealth and living standards, people moving into more Western-sized style living standards, which, as you know, will be a massive draw on resources, whether it's just for better quality food, which, you know, sort of meat and protein, which, by the way, which draw on a lot of water, but also people will be drawing on and demanding things like cars, mobile phones, indoor plumbing, and all of these things, although we take them for granted, are a massive draw on the world's resources. The third key aspect of this big push for demand for resources is urbanization. As I mentioned, almost 90% of the world's population lives in the emerging world. I'm sure in a sophisticated audience like this one, many of you will have been to some of the sprawling metropoles of the world, like Mexico City or Lagos or Beijing, where populations are 15 to 20 million people. And there is a very deliberate approach by many governments, the Chinese government included, to actually urbanize much more dramatically. And that's partly so that these governments can provide and deliver services such as healthcare and education to a more concentrated population. But the implications of having more people living in urban areas, again, are a huge draw on natural resources. I've mentioned already people wanting to, are demanding indoor plumbing, better quality foods, cars, and so on, people living in urban areas, but also the quality of buildings that they live in is also heavily demanding on coal and electricity and clean water. Today, just to give you some estimates, there are about 3 billion people who live in urban areas. By 2030, the estimates are that there'll be 5 billion people living in the urban areas, again, mainly coming from the emerging markets. There are 9 cities in the United States that have a population of 1 million or more. In the European Union, there are about 20 cities like that. In China, there are almost 100 already. And as I said, this is a very deliberate campaign by the Chinese government to try and get more people in the urban areas. So those are the three key drivers. Much more detail in the book, but the fundamental combination of population growth, the population of the world getting wealthier, and urbanization is really going to put much more pressure on global resources. Now, in isolation, you might say, well, what's the big deal? But we obviously have to look at the other side of the equation. How much are we able to supply for all this increase in demand? And let me just quickly walk you through these four categories of the commodity complex: land, water, energy, and minerals, to give you a bit of a snapshot of where the world is today. Let's start with land. There are about 13 billion hectares of land on the planet. That's equivalent to about 16 times the size of the United States. However, only 11%, so about 1.4 billion hectares, is actually arable land. Now, it might sound like, oh, you know, what's the big deal again? But if you think about it, arable land is not just for us as human beings to live on, but animals need to live on it as well. And also, we have to, in order to grow plants, we do need arable land. We build our cities on arable land, which means that there's much less space and less opportunity for us to grow crops on this land. And increasingly, because of desertification and because the population is growing so much, we're going to find that there'll be more people fighting to live on smaller patches of land. Water, it's a very, very big deal. Just a few months ago, the United States National Intelligence Council put out a report, and I encourage you, people who are interested in this, to have a look at it, a report claiming that there will be many more water wars emerging. Just for your information, there are already 25 wars raging today in the world that have their origins in resources. And of those 25, none of them are water-related. In the book, I actually have a reference to a fantastic database which has details water wars dating back over the past 1,000 years. Water wars are a very big deal. There are many, many countries already engaged in water conflicts. We expect that there'll be many more. To put this into context, 70% of the earth is water, but less than 1% is available for us to consume, not just for drinking and sustenance of life, but even for sanitation. We cannot use the polluted or salinated water even to flush our toilets. So it's a very, very serious problem. And the question is, what are we doing about that? We'll get to that later. The third aspect is energy. The world consumes 85 million barrels of oil every single day. The United States consumes about 20 million barrels. And it's very, very serious in terms of depletion. An example of this is that we today are consuming energy fines or oil fines dating back to the 1950s. To put that in another way, we're in 2012. With all the information we have on technology, with all the information that can help us find potentially other discoveries of oil, we still have not found enough oil, and we still are living off of the discoveries that were made in the 1950s. I will say one other quick thing is that every now and then you read the paper and you hear sort of euphoria around a new oil well that's been discovered. And my favorite one recently is the discovery of the Tupi oil fields off of the offshore Brazil. The announcement that came out a couple of years ago was that they had discovered about 123 billion barrels of oil in offshore Brazil. The market sold off because people thought, oh, gosh, now we're going to be flooded with oil. What they neglected to mention is that that oil is under 2 miles of salt. And even with the technology that we have today, with all the advancements that have been made, it's pretty much impossible to access that oil in the bottom of the sea. And even if we were able to, the estimates are that it would cost over $500 billion to get access to that resource. So the oil picture is a very, very big concern moving forward. Finally, minerals. Minerals are something that we don't really talk about a lot. However, China, one of the biggest mineral consumers in the world, it consumes about 40% of copper, for example, is desperately scouring the earth to try and get more access to copper. And the reason largely driven by the fact that copper features in everything from microphones to mobile phones to indoor plumbing to wireless wiring and technology within the house, washing machines, irons, and so on. Significant pressure on things like copper. So that is the supply picture. And I probably, you know, for purposes of where we are right now, I've watered it down quite considerably. Corporations are having to go further afield into more dangerous places, politically dangerous and dangerous in terms of terrain in order to get access to these resources. The incident a few years ago in Chile with the copper mine there is very emblematic of the sort of difficulties that companies are finding in order to extract these minerals from different places around the world. You can expect that many more people will people are not getting into these areas, so you find that not only there's a declining asset quality, but it's very hard to get human capital involved. The other sort of hidden cost of this is every year numerous people die in these projects to try and get access to oil, try to get access to copper, to iron, and so on. And I know that the Macondo issue, the offshore BP, was a big deal in the United States, but I can assure you that around the world, with even with best intentions of corporations, many, many, many thousands of people die every year trying to deliver these minerals and energy to us living in different parts of the world. So that was really, if I haven't depressed you enough, that was the global picture. Let me spend a bit of time talking about China specifically and what some of the dynamics are. Again, using this framework, the demand side and the supply side, and give you a bit more color there. So China's population now is approaching 1.4 billion. About 300 million of the population, shall we say, lives like us, so Western standards of living. They've got a billion people who live in pretty dire economic situations. The conversation today is focusing on China, but for every time I mention China, you can multiply that by a factor because there are people across Africa, across South America, across Eastern Europe, across India, who are expecting and hoping to have better lives and lives that reflect more the lives that you're leading here in the United States. In India, the population is growing so rapidly. They have a population growing at about a million people per month. And again, we know what the story there. There's been a positive story of economic growth, but it's very hard to actually meet a lot of the resource demand that would be coming from that population. It's not the first time that China and India have been the largest economies in the world. If you look back at Angus Maddison, late Angus Maddison has a fantastic database going back to the 1820s. So the wealth story of China and India is now coming back. They made a few mistakes that cost them about 300 years of economic development, but here they are growing quite rapidly and actually trying to improve living standards. It's worth pointing out here that there is a political imperative for these countries to deliver economic growth. If you look across the emerging world, 60% of the population, 70% in some cases, is under the age of 24. They have to deliver economic growth and improvements in living standards, otherwise they will have a political crisis. In fact, although I know the Arab Spring has tended to be reported as a sort of cry or fight for democracy, it's my contention that actually that it's more about people, very large pockets of disaffected people who are frustrated when they go on Facebook or on the internet and they see places like China and India and Brazil doing incredibly well, and they look at their own lives and they don't see that the improvements are coming rapidly enough. So the challenges are going to be not only about managing this population growth, but also making sure that we can provide for this increasing wealth and demands from people around the world. As you know, China's economic growth and concerns about wealth are kind of now a lot in the newspapers because there has been a slowdown. But the economy, in terms of the worst-case estimates that I've seen, are around 7%, 7.5%. We'll talk a little bit later about why I think that you should not think that the Chinese are sort of going to be down and out. It is a political imperative. The Chinese government will do everything in its power to actually improve and make sure that they continue on an economic path. It's worth making the point here that China has traditionally, or certainly over the last several decades, been heavily driven by investment. The government has spent a lot of money in investment. About 45 to 50% of the country's GDP has been investment. If you compare consumption versus the U.S., you can see that the Chinese government is now on a very deliberate campaign to try and encourage the Chinese population to consume more. Chinese consumption, private consumption as a share of GDP is around 35%, between 30 and 35%. In the United States, it's about 70% of GDP. Those are probably both too much at the extreme. You know, obviously, that the U.S. government and the U.S. policymakers are trying to curb consumption to some degree. But at the same time, economists have talked a lot about the need for China to increase her consumption, and that's a very active policy that the government is pursuing right now. The implications of that are, again, a draw on resources. They're trying to encourage people to buy what we call white goods, washing machines, computers, cars, and so on. And that is, I don't need to rehash that, but as I said earlier, can be quite quite demanding in terms of resources. I talked about urbanization earlier on. Just to give you a few statistics that are quite interesting, I believe, with regards to specifically China and urbanization. By 2025, remember we're in 2012 already, by 2025, a billion Chinese will live in cities. The urban economy will generate about 90% of China's GDP. They expect that there will be 221 cities in China that have a population of a million or more. There'll be 23 cities that have 5 million or more people, and they will have 8 cities. Remember I said that there are 9 cities in America that have a million. There will be 8 cities in China with 10 million or more people. The 10 million number is my personal favorite because I come from a country that has 10 million people. And I can one of the things we'll talk about later is the need for us as a global community to work together on these issues, because if you think about it, what China is trying to do to move a billion people out of poverty is something that even my country with just 10 million people has failed to do. So they have an incredibly daunting task ahead of them, and what they need is more support and encouragement so that the whole world can benefit, as opposed to a lot of the criticism that you hear in the press. But we will come back to that later. The other quick point I'll make about urbanization is that I have a lot of data looking at the sensitivity of China's consumption of different commodities, some agriculture products, metals and minerals, and China's sensitivity, the urbanization sensitivity. And by that, I mean for every additional person who moves into an urban area into China, the increase in copper consumption, in soybean consumption, sugar consumption, is much higher than it would be for the global average. So urbanization is going to be a massive, massive push on the demands of China. My final point in this side of the demand question is even with China's per capita income right now. So remember, people like to say, well, China's the second largest economy in the world now, which is true, and therefore it must be rich. On a per capita income basis, it's around number 100, which makes it even poorer than many, many of the African countries that you hear about. In fact, just based on the population, because there are about a billion people in Africa, there are more poor people in China than there are in Africa, more poor people in India than there are in Africa. The questions and the issues that the populations in China and India are dealing with are absolutely daunting. And I think, I'm sure people in this room have been to these places, but as an African who's traveled to both, the degree of poverty that I've seen having traveled across Africa, but also to China and India. When I've been to China and India, the degrees of poverty that I've seen there are far worse than anything I've seen across the African continent. And a lot of that has to do with the population density and how you manage that. Let me just say a few things. So I've given you the demand story on China. Again, looking at GDP growth, looking at the wealth of the population, and looking at urbanization trends. Let me say very quickly a few things about supply. Commodities that matter for China. In terms of food, one of the big demands is soybeans. China's got quite enough corn, quite enough wheat, quite enough sugar, but soybeans, they've got a massive deficit. They consume about 27% of the world's soybeans, and they only produce about 5% of the world's soybeans. This is great for the U.S. because the U.S. and Brazil are massive exporters of soybeans, but the implications can be quite significant because it obviously changes what American farmers are willing to plant. So those are sort of the discussions that policymakers like to have. In terms of water shortages, not only is water, we talked about this, a big deal on a global scale. In China, it is a massive problem. Partly because of pollution, but partly because in terms of the world average, China it falls far below the world average in terms of water available per person. Very serious problem, and to that extent, the Chinese government has actually been rerouting rivers. One of the places of contention has been the Brahmaputra River in India, and there has been a lot of discussion on that between the Chinese and the Indians. Oil. The United States consumes 9 times on a per capita basis, 9 times more oil than China. China, as I said, is 10% of world consumption of energy. Of the 85 million barrels that we consume every day, the United States is about a quarter of the amount of energy we consume in a day. I know these numbers sound like numbers, but let me give you a bit more color. In the United States, for every 1,000 people, about 800 people have a car. In China, for every 1,000 people, only 75 have a car. If every Chinese, or even the average Chinese person, started to live, if we got the ratios in the United States, the estimates that we're talking about having an additional 900 million cars in China, 900 million cars. And at that case, in that situation, we would expect that China's demand on oil would increase to around 35 million barrels of oil demand every single day. The Earth cannot support that. We just don't have enough resources for that. And again, this is just for China. The copper story, same problem. They have copper consumption in China today is 6 times above its domestic production. Many of you will know that recently commodity prices have come down, and I keep hearing from people, commodity prices have come down. China has stockpiled its inventories of copper, as an example. Just to make sure that you appreciate how bad the situation is, China, as some of the estimates are that China has about 1 million tons of copper in inventory right now. And that sounds like a lot, but they consume 22 million tons of copper every year. So 1 million is just not that much. It's not a drop in the ocean. It's just a drop in the ocean. Demand, supply, it's not a pretty picture. What is going on? And I think the thing that shocks me in writing this book is that the information that I've presented to you here is drawn from many different sources, many of them government sources. And the thing that sort of surprised me the most was that with all the information that we have, with all the fears about scarcity, commodity scarcity, and all these different parts of the commodity complex, there does not exist a single international body that does nothing else but focus on commodities. We have the Copenhagen Consensus that focuses on environment. We have the World Trade Organization that focuses on trade. Through the G20, we have a focus on banking regulation. But with all the pressures, and remembering from high school, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, we need to eat, we need to survive, we need to have shelter. These are basic human requirements. But with all the information we have about how serious these problems are going to be, there is no international body that does nothing else but focus on the commodity headwinds. And to me, this is where I find the biggest surprise. Commodity prices since 2009, so after the financial crash, since 2009 have increased by 150%. I mentioned to you earlier that there are already 25 wars around the world, excluding water wars, and yet we already know through the U.S. intelligence agencies and just looking around the world, places like the Middle East, parts of Africa, where there are already droughts. Even places like Australia have had 9 droughts in the past century. These are serious problems that are emerging around the world, but nothing is really being done about it in a cohesive and coordinated way. Let me read for you very quickly something that from the U.S. National Intelligence Council. This is the report that I referred to. Over the next 10 years, water shortages and government failures to manage them are likely to lead to social disruptions, pressure on national and local leaders, and potential political instability. As water shortages become more acute beyond the next 10 years, water in shared basins will increasingly be used as leverage. The use of water as a weapon or to further terrorist objectives also will become more likely in the next 10 years. Serious, serious problem. Nothing is really being done about it, except by China. Let me explain to you what China is doing. China has adopted what I call a three-pronged approach to deal with her commodity shortage issue. The first part is that China has befriended the axis of the unloved. These are regions around the world that have traditionally been ignored or bereft of Western investment. Places like Africa, across South America, Eastern Europe, and basically all around the world. And what I'd like to do, if you don't mind, is give you a few examples of what's going on. In 2007, the Chinese bought Mount Toromocho in Peru. It's half the size of Mount Everest, and they paid $3 billion to buy this mountain full of copper. By rough estimates, the amount of copper that is contained in there, if you used market prices today, it's probably worth about $18 trillion, enormous amount. The Chinese have engaged in swaps. They've given money to the Brazilians, and in return, they're getting beef and chicken access, so beef and chicken swaps with the Chinese. In Russia, they've engaged in 25-year oil swaps, so they've invested money with Russia. In return, they're getting access to all or a large proportion of Russia's oil production. Kazakhstan, similar sort of thing. In return for money to going into investment into Kazakhstan, they're getting access to uranium to support their nuclear programs at home in China to provide energy. Just next door to your north, Canada, there was recently announced a laptops for pork program. The Chinese were going to provide laptops to the Canadians, and in return, the Canadians are going to provide pork. My personal favorite is an African story. The distance from Cape to Cairo in Africa is about 9,000 miles, which is three times the distance of New York to California, three times that distance. It's pretty much all tarred. You can drive that whole distance. It will take you about 5 weeks, and you'll go through 15 countries, and there are these massive billboards, as you cross different borders, saying this is a gift from the government of the Republic of China. This is already happening across not just Africa, but around the world. The largest recipient of foreign direct investment, particularly in the commodity space, is Australia. In North America, the United States and Canada, a close second. And all of this has been done in a very short period of time. The first outward investment of China in terms of this global approach was actually in 2005, and was marked by an investment that they made into Lenovo, the IBM Lenovo transaction. This was 2005. But since then, this is 7 years later, their campaign for commodity resources has been so aggressive that estimates are that they're spending about $1 billion a week to get access to resources. So massive, massive campaign, very systematic, very well organized, and they have the companies both vertically and horizontally working together. So they will put together companies that have a shipping company, will work with an infrastructure building company, will work with a mining company, will work with a company that knows how to build houses. So when they appear in Turkey, where they have a massive investment, they have a company. These companies work together. They build the ships, which will deliver things back to China, and they will roll out the roads. They will build houses for workers, and they will also pursue very aggressively the investment strategy of building mines. So it's very systematic, it's very deliberate, but more importantly, it's symbiotic. The Chinese, in many countries, are actually loved. There was a Pew survey, the research institute, the Pew Institute, wrote a report in 2007. They went to 10 countries in Africa, and they asked the Africans, what do you think about the Chinese? Do you like them? Do you hate them? Are they better or worse than the Americans? And by wide margins, 95%, 97%, the Africans said, we love the Chinese. They're providing us with investment. They're providing us with trade. Just to give you a quick sidebar, Africa has got about 1 billion people, as I mentioned, which is about now 15% of the world's population. It's less than 2% of world trade. And a lot of that is because the United States and Europe have had farm subsidy programs that have locked out not just Africa, but a lot of South American countries. And this has decimated many African families and African farmers who are not able to grow food and sell it abroad. Well, the Chinese have come in. China's got about 10% arable land, 1.4 billion people to feed, very happy to do deals in Africa. So Africans, by wide margins, said, we think the Chinese are great, we love them here, and we also prefer them to the Americans. No offense. Don't shoot me. I'm just a messenger. Anyway, that's the first part, befriending the access of the unloved. People need the Chinese to invest. We need to trade. We've got large populations of young people who need to work, who need opportunities, and the Chinese are providing them. The second thing is this idea of zero cost of capital. It seems that the Chinese have a bottomless pit of money. They've got about $3 trillion, over $3 trillion now, of foreign reserves. They go around the world, and to many people, people think they overpay for resources. So overpaying meaning this podium might be worth $100 to you and I. You think that's Price is Right, fair price, $100, but the Chinese might pay $500 for it. And if you go to a lot of investment banking conferences, as I have done in the past, people snicker, oh, these guys don't know how to calculate what it is. What they're missing is that the Chinese are very smart. They have bigger and broader utility function. They don't value a podium just because it's a podium. They value a podium or a mining, maybe a mine is a better example. They value the mine because of what it can do to improve the livelihoods of the people at home. It's not just about profits. It's about making sure that people's livelihood are improved. So this is zero cost of capital, the government heavily involved, supporting its corporations abroad, negotiating deals, and creating an environment that is very positive for the people on the ground. I'll whiz through the last few points. The third part of this strategy is that China has become a monopsonist. This is the go-to buyer for resources. Let me just explain what a monopsonist is. A monopolist, as we know, is the one supplier of something. A monopsonist is the one buyer of something. So think about a big supermarket in Iowa, where it has lots of farmers who grow corn, but because the supermarket is so big, it's the buyer of all the corn in this neighborhood. Well, because it's such a big buyer, it's actually the supermarket that can start to set the price of how much they're going to pay for a cob of corn. You might say it's 50 cents, take it or leave it. So the farmers are forced to respond to that. Well, that's actually what's happening in many commodity markets now around the world. Copper and coal in particular have become very sensitive to whatever happens in China. What goes on in China happens reflected in the markets. So China has become a monopsonist, and increasingly there's a belief that she will continue to do so. I'm mindful of the time, so I'm just going to really whiz through quickly the last part, which is this issues, the sort of outstanding issues and sort of the controversial aspects of China's sort of campaign for resources. The first one that you hear a lot of is this claim of neocolonialism. The Chinese are on a campaign to colonize certainly Africa, but maybe other parts of the world as well. And I think this is absolutely unfounded and actually rubbish. They have a massive problem at home. As I said already, spare a thought for the Chinese policymakers. They've got a billion people who are demanding better livelihoods. They've seen 300 million people's lives change in 30 years. They want some of that. So the notion that the Chinese would ignore that at home and start going out to try and colonize is just completely nonsense as far as I'm concerned. Remember that there are difficulties. African policymakers, Brazilian policymakers around the world have to understand that the Chinese interest is actually purely economic. And it can be quite dangerous, because if you have a copper mine, you know that at some point, this is a depleting asset, the copper will be finished in that mine. And I would hazard a guess that the Chinese at that time will show no more interest in these countries. And so that's a question for policymakers in the host countries to be a bit more sensitive, save their money, think about how to extend the value of the money that they're getting. But the notion of neocolonialism I dismiss outright. I think it's just unfounded. There's no evidence. In fact, if anything, I would be more sympathetic to the criticism that the Chinese don't care enough about the politics and the political environment in which they're doing business. The issue of prisoners, we've done a lot of research to try and find any evidence. And remember, we're living in a camera-ready world. Everybody's got a camera on their phone. To try and get a sense of where are these stories coming from about prisoner use. There is absolutely no evidence that on a systematic basis the Chinese are engaged in use of prisoners. Now, this is not to say that the Chinese are perfect and everything is wonderful. Of course, we need to police and make sure that the Chinese behave appropriately. But I think it's very damaging for these old wives' tales to sort of circulate as truth when the evidence is very scant. I'm very open to see the type of challenges that people make towards the Chinese, but it's not just a Chinese issue. It's more broadly about investors, whether they're domestic investors, international investors. We should be on their case. Another thing that we hear a lot about, labor ratios. Again, this tends to be an Africa story. People say they don't hire any Africans. They just bring in Chinese staff. In the book, I have, I think it's about 15 examples of projects using official data from the governments in these countries, from international agencies such as the New York Times, Reuters, Human Rights Watch, and the ratios of the Africans hired to the Chinese hired significantly higher, so as many as 15 to 1, 10 to 1, and so on. So again, this is another mistruth, misinformation that tends to spread quite widely. Let me just say here that ultimately, as I pointed out a moment ago, it is about what the role of the host government is. So the governments have to be strong enough to make sure that they're not being taken advantage of. The reason we don't complain about the Chinese in the United States is because you believe that your government is going to do the right thing, and you can hold your government accountable when they behave in a bad way. That is the sort of environment that all of these countries should aspire to. And we should be asking the question, why is it the case that governments are weak in so many different parts of the world? And I know I don't have time to talk about it now, but I think a lot of that is the historical context of African governments in particular, but other countries as well, being heavily reliant on aid and therefore being allowed to abdicate their responsibilities. But that is changing very rapidly. Western donors, as we know, are suffering from their own budget constraints. And, you know, there is benefit coming from the Chinese incursion. I'm going to say two last things. Basically, what I'm proposing in the book, and what I think is really important, is that you can see that China's approach is quite multilateral. They've gone to different countries across the globe. They're engaging. They're being quite symbiotic. They're giving, investing a lot of money in return for getting these resources. And it seems to work. There will be challenges, of course, but for now, it's broadly working. This is a very, very different approach from the approach the United States has tended to take to secure resources. The U.S. has tended to use military action, and I think that that sort of approach has tended to be quite detrimental for everyone in the world. It seems to work in past decades, but now there's a new suitor in town, and I think it's very important that the U.S. takes the lead and showing that we can sit around the table and negotiate deals. The U.S. has to be involved. It's still the leading economy in the world. It is still an important economy, and it's really important that the U.S. gets involved. The last part in the book, as I go through some policy choices, both very macro, so talking about things like what this agency might look like, but I also drill down very specifically on policies that can be implemented, both demand-side policies, so things like taxes, and supply-side policies, things like innovation and R&D, that can be implemented in order for us to improve the outlook for land, water, energy, and minerals. So very specific policies are addressed in the book. I'm looking at the clock. I really want to hear what people have to say, so I'm going to stop here. There's lots more I could talk about, but I will shut up. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dambisa. I think we have an audience to match your vast canvas, because the range of questions that we got is pretty extraordinary. I think we've got economists, historians, technologists, demographers, policymakers, et cetera, in the room. But let me start with this. One of the questions, and I'll dip into each of these categories, there's a question here from the historians, I think, in the room, say, how is what China is doing different from other historical periods, either empires or countries, and how they've approached their thirst and voracious appetite for resources. Maybe you could compare that with the United Kingdom at different periods, or the French with different empires and periods in history.
Yeah, sure. So I think it's really in terms of the aggression. If you look back at the colonial approaches, they've tended to be very aggressive. There was no symbiosis, per se. They went into these countries. They basically ruled these countries as colonial powers, and they extracted minerals, and there was really not much. I think probably somebody like Neil Ferguson would dispute this, but there was not much gain for the countries, the host countries of these resources. So I think there is a very, very big difference. The Chinese court and cater to the African population. They had a massive conference in Africa, I think it was 06 now, 2006. They imported giraffes and elephants, and they had an amazing array in Beijing. They flew on all these presidents. I mean, they make a huge effort to sort of court and cater to the African leadership and to many other places around the world, not just Africa. Today, China is the leading investor and leading trading partner for many countries in South America, like Brazil, Colombia, Chile, and so on. That's right here, you know, in America's backyard. People feel happy about engaging with the Chinese. They don't feel threatened politically. It's not by a gun. It's by negotiation. And that's why I think it's really important that, you know, that not only we get some competition from the United States, but also it's important that the host countries in these regions become smarter.
On the same note, can you explain, therefore, why aren't we seeing the same things from countries like India, for example? So how does China's approach differ from India? You might argue they have the same challenges and pressures, or even Brazil.
So I think the big distinction there is the idea of state capitalism. As people know in this room, India is the largest democracy in the world. China has a very different approach politically and also economically. The Chinese government is involved in pretty much everything. And this is obviously the Communist Party. And I have to say, if you have time, and you know, I think we should be thrilled to be living in the era that we do, because it's actually not that expensive. I mean, it's not cheap, but it's not so exorbitantly expensive to go to both countries, to go to India and China. And I would urge people to try and do that. For me, it's been incredibly eye-opening. It's a live experiment. You have two countries, about the same population, 1.3 billion, 1.4 billion population. One is democratic. One has got a very different system of government, non-democratic. One is uses state capitalism very effectively in terms of economics. And they have about the same degree of poverty. But if you go to, my experience has been, if you go to China, it actually feels like something is going on there. It doesn't feel chaotic. It's very organized, but the government is definitely involved in everything. The infrastructure build-out, the story of importing resources involved in everything from education, healthcare, I mean, all aspects. And, you know, as a free marketeer, I mean, I think I say that with a small f. It might sound odd to you that I would say that there's a lot of value in that, but I do think there's a lot of values, particularly when you look at what's going on in India. I mean, India doesn't feel like there's an organized system. It feels rather chaotic. They've got many of the similar challenges, but the government, the reason they're not going out and trying to get resources is I feel that it's very much run as more private capitalism, less role of the state, less role of government, and I think that you can see that in their approach.
I think from The Economist, I think often we talk a lot about the fact that China needs to move to being a more consumption-driven economy as opposed to an investment-driven economy. How do you square that imperative with the pressure that might create on the resource question? Because it seems like we're speaking out of both sides when we find as economists we say that.
Oh, but that's what economists do. We're very good at on the one hand and on the other hand. We need to kind of understand why it is that China is pursuing a more consumption-driven approach. I think, to me, in large part, and having had conversations with a lot of Chinese policymakers, you know, for the last several decades, they've done phenomenally well by relying on an export industry. They have been able to export goods not just to the United States but across the world, and that has done them, you know, very well. They've created employment at home. It created a lot of returns in terms of cash. It built a whole export sector. But in the new world order, where the importing countries like the United States across Europe are having their own economic challenges, it seems quite sensible that they would focus on domestic demand and consumption, and that's what they're doing, very, very deliberately. People will know again that every 5 years, the Chinese government has a plan that they announce, and they say these are the things that we're going to focus on for the next 5 years. Their last plan, which was in 2010, I think it was, was absolutely deliberately focused on getting households to stop spending money on education and healthcare. The government said, we'll take care of that. We want you to spend that money on white goods. And if you think about it, they are, you know, they want their population to start demanding things like televisions and computers and washing machines, which are being built in China. And that will help build the economics and build up the economy domestically.
I think quite a few people are wondering about the role in all of this of multilateral organizations, the World Bank. I mean, you worked at the World Bank. The role of monetary institutions, the role of currencies, and the recent devaluation. Can you talk a little bit about what role does the financial system, how we value currencies, what the World Bank does, what the IMF does, what role does it play in all of this?
So very good question. On Wednesday, just the day before yesterday, I was actually at the World Bank doing this similar speech. I had a similar discussion. And I have to come back here to talk about this other thing that I seem to be, I feel I'm observing, which is the schism emerging between developed countries and developing countries. Developing countries, I mean, we all have global issues, but I think developing countries increasingly feel like their issues are very different from what's happening in the West right now. And the implication of that is that you see that countries like China, India, Brazil are increasing the amount of reserves that they have. And it's almost an indirect way of delinking their dependency on these multilateral institutions. One of the things I said at the World Bank was that, you know, you would expect that the existing institutions would be much more involved in with China, with many of the emerging markets. But as you can see, that especially with the last choice of president, both of the IMF and the World Bank, I think the sentiment is moving against a sort of globalized world. And I think there's much more protectionism happening across many different countries. But you're seeing that the emerging world is forming its own banks. Chinese are now using the renminbi to lend money, to do swaps. And I think that that's really, there's a sub-story going on here where they're basically building these new relationships without the traditional institutions. With regards to the exchange rate and interest rates and monetary policy, one of the things that I think we as people who have been educated in the West or think of in a Western framework, I think we tend to miss the fact that the Chinese model is completely different from ours. And it's hard for us to, and I don't mean that in a flippant way. I mean it in the way that we need to force ourselves to try and understand more that our strictures, discounted cash flows, exchange rates, you know, interest rates, that model doesn't necessarily apply in a place like China. Last week, they had an interest rate cut. Interest rate cuts matter in the United States because most people have a business a credit card. Most people have a checking account. Most people have a mortgage. In a place like China, what proportion of the population has these things? It's tiny. So the sort of ripple effect or the knock-on effects of monetary policy, as we know, it would be very different. I would say the same about the exchange rate. I would say that it seems very unlikely that the sort of problem that you're seeing in Europe would occur in China, because you can expect that the Chinese government will do everything in its power, to death does it part, to keep the economy going. And many of those things will fall out of our mindset, of our strictures, whereas the ECB might say, well, we can't do this because we're not allowed to focus on certain policy aspects. We're only here to fight inflation. The Chinese government will do anything and go anywhere to keep the economic growth going. It's a very, very different model. We have to tweak our mindset. And so although I'm sympathetic to questions around the exchange rate and what policies China might do, I just think we're doing ourselves a disservice by looking at it in the same lens as we would for the U.S., for example.
Let's turn to Africa for a moment. Several questions here. Let me pick a few of them. One is, is there anything that, for example, African nations could do to better coordinate their negotiations and responses to the Chinese? Would that change things? Let me add another related question. It seems recently that one of the key things that China is doing in Africa is to do a bit of a land grab. What will that do to small rural farmers and rural development and those kinds of concerns?
So with regards to coordination, it's not just about, for me, it's not just about coordination with regards to managing China. I wish there were more coordination in general. In Africa, and by that I mean regional integration. Both James and I are next door neighbors in Southern Africa. My country, as I said, is about 10-13 million people. Not a real city in China. But the region of Southern Africa is about 250 million people. Now, that's a very different proposition. But we all have different flags, different currency, different governors, different presidents. I mean, it's not a formula for success for these regions, in, particularly as the world is becoming so competitive. You know, if you travel to a place like Malaysia, this is an economy where people have done the right thing. The government policymakers have done a lot, and the economy grew, and it's done really well. But it's now kind of stalling at, you know, a certain level of growth, let's say 5% economic growth. And at that point, they still have large pockets of poverty. But what additional policies can a government do? Those are the really difficult places, because what is the difference between Turkey and Malaysia or Chile for an investor? These are three countries that are doing pretty well. Where should I put my money? In places like Africa, I think there's a lot of low-hanging fruit, and I think regional integration, not just with the Chinese, but in general, is so imperative for economic growth. But to be, you know, very specific, I do think that I'm not a bureaucrat, and I tend to really hate these sort of overlayered institutions that love to write reports and not really like to execute. But I think that there are some institutions in Africa that could be more effective actually integrating some of the frameworks that the Chinese are adopting and becoming more engaged in that regard. Very quickly, with regards to the land grab, this is once again, I think these are things that people say without really thinking about too hard, maybe there's a lack of knowledge. Most African countries, you don't get a freehold. You cannot own land outright. You get a leasehold. So it's actually, as you know, in Zimbabwe, for example, it's been a big issue and big contention. Land issues are very, very serious. But it's very difficult for even the Chinese to get outright freeholds. What they do get is land, is leaseholds, and they do use the land. And I think that there are, in many countries, a lot of significant changes into the amount of land usage they can have. Brazil is very similar. The Chinese were very welcomed in Brazil when Brazil's income was much lower. Now that they've improved so significantly over the last decade or so, the policies around land usage by the Chinese and by foreigners in general have become much more stringent, much more difficult to use. So I think land grab, I would say, is not really the right language I would use.
So as you look at what China is doing in Africa in particular, but also arguably elsewhere in the developing world, how much impact is China actually having on development of those regions? And also, could you contrast that, for example, because there used to be a time when the U.S. was, in fact, the leader in terms of developmental aid and driving growth and development in these countries. How has that changed, and how is the U.S. seen in that light?
Yeah, I mean, I think China's role in economic development and in these different regions will be judged in future is by how clever the policymakers in the host nations have been. And I said it earlier, but let me just reiterate. It's essential for these countries to understand that they are sitting on depleting assets. Copper mines, they have a life of 20, 25 years. Oil wells, the depletion rates, the bigger they are, the depletion rates go down really quickly. They very rarely last 10 years or 20 years. And so if African leaders, Brazilian, Argentinian, you know, Kazakhstani policymakers can appreciate the fact that they're sitting on a resource that is depleting and that the Chinese are really not in these regions for anything more than to get these resources, I think it can actually be quite beneficial. As I said earlier, these are large populations with significantly young people. We need to create jobs. We need to trade. We need to engage. There are policies that need to be taken, and it's very important for the leaders of these regions to understand that this is not an open-ended money coming in perpetuity. These are temporary flows linked to the life of the resource. With regards to the United States and Europe, my previous book, In Dead Aid, I mean, I talk about the fact that I do think that the policies that were used for emerging markets in general over the past 30 years have meant that there's been a big miss. It's not the end of the world, and the U.S. can reinvent itself and rebuild relationships. I think right now my biggest concern is that American policymakers in particular, but Europeans as well, are still relying on very negative rhetoric. I don't have my book handy, but I would have read for you what Secretary Hillary Clinton statement she made in Zambia last year. You know, very sort of suspicious. You should be wary of people who. Oh, actually, Kevin will give me a copy of the book. I'll read it for you. But thank you. So. If you don't mind, in June 2011, during the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act meetings in Africa, just very quickly, the Africa Growth and Opportunities Act is a program by the United States I consider it giving crumbs to Africa because, as we know, they've got farm subsidies that lock a lot of African produce out. But what they've done is they've come up with this thing called AGOA, the African Growth Opportunities Act, which is basically to say, okay, we'll renegotiate with some of you countries and we'll let you sell some of your goods into the United States. So this is supposed to be a second place prize, I would say. But anyway, in June 2011, during the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act meetings in Africa, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton cautioned that Africa must be aware of new colonialism and reminded the audience that we saw this during colonial times. It is easy to come in, take out natural resources, pay off leaders, and leave. Although China was never explicitly mentioned, her comments were quickly interpreted as a thinly veiled attack aimed at China. And to me, this is not the America that I know and love. I would expect America to change the rhetoric. American policymakers should change the rhetoric of places like Africa from what I call the four horsemen of Africa's apocalypse. Stop talking about corruption, disease, war, and poverty as being the characterization of Africa, and start to encourage your investment community to go and have a good look. There are now 15 countries in Africa that have credit ratings. We've got 16 stock markets. The majority of the stocks that trade in Africa are non-commodity stocks. They're banking stocks. They're retail companies. They're telecommunication companies. There's lots of stuff going on, lots of trade between Brazil and Africa and China and Africa, India and Africa, and so on. And I think that is a better type of story to spin than to use this sort of negatively laced language. So to your question, it's a long-winded way of saying, when you say, you know, the U.S. had a very different, had an approach to Africa, had an approach to Brazil and elsewhere in the world, they did have an approach. The approach was wrong. I think the aid approach has never, in the history of the world, there's not a single country that's ever achieved economic growth and reduced poverty in a meaningful way by relying on aid. So it is the wrong policy. The policy is trade. The policy is foreign direct investment. The policy is capital markets, is transparency. And those are the things that people want around the world. And so if the United States can change the tone, and not just the tone of places like Africa and Brazil, but change the tone towards China. I can't tell you how many times I've been to China and people say, we just wish the Americans would say something nice for once. Why do you always have to say the Nobel Prize goes to the most recent dissident? Why can't they say, you know what, gosh, Chinese government, what you guys have done in the past 30 years, that is damn impressive. 300 million people in 30 years, that is impressive. You know, we want to give you credit, we want to give you help, we want to support you. And they're right to some extent. I mean, I every time, yesterday when President Obama and Mitt Romney were in Ohio, all the rhetoric about China's negative. Oh, the Chinese are cheat, the Chinese are this. And, you know, it's like we're living in a globalized world. Let's work together. These are problems that we all face, $100 of oil. Let's try and solve these problems together. It's not going to be helpful to be to create these schisms.
Yeah, actually, on that note, I'm going to skip to there are a set of questions here. Obviously, it's an election year, so people are election-oriented questions. But let me ask them this way. If you were to advise the next president of the United States on how to think about, from a policy standpoint, how to deal with these issues in China around this issue of resources, what policy agenda, what would be your set of recommendations for the next president?
So the first thing I'd say is, I suppose this is apropos being in California, I'd say make love, not war. I think that, the U.S. needs to make friends. You know, there's been way too much of this us versus them. Just try and walk a mile in the shoes of an Indian policymaker. And not just in a sort of what can I get out of this, but genuinely try and do understand what these countries are facing, the difficult challenge, the impatience that people have. They're frustrated. We've spent too many decades in poverty with governments that have underperformed. It's a new world order. And I think, you know, it would be very interesting if the United States government, for example, set up a department to even just engage with China. back to your multilateral question, I really wish that the IMF and World Bank would have much more partnership with China, because China has done something that nobody else has done. They've done something incredibly phenomenal, and many countries around the world that have similar problems of income inequality and poverty and disease and so on are looking to China now and saying, you know what, we want to do what they've done. And so I think there's an absolutely massive role for the United States to play, and I really hope that they take the baton and be serious about this.
Well, since there's so many questions on this one, let me add a few more. How complicated is the United States' position on China and resource questions? How complicated is it by the fact that there's this codependency economically between China and the United States?
So people say there's codependency. Remember what I said earlier about symbiosis. The Chinese give you money, and in return they get access to your most important resource, whether it's a copper mine, it's a land or oil. Well, in the United States, they did the same thing. They gave you money, and in return they got access to the most important resource in the United States, which is the American consumer. And it is a symbiotic thing. I know people tend to think, the Chinese are sort of in cahoots, you know, in the sense that they can't break out of this. I think they are making big moves to try and water down their dependency on the United States. We talked already about domestic demand, really trying to move away from the export sector story. They are diversifying their reserves into gold. They are diversifying their use of their renminbi. I mean, I think that it's not going to always be, it's not a static relationship, and I think the Chinese recognize that they can't be dependent. But at the same time, I think what the U.S. needs to do is to broaden her reach in a more positive way.
Perhaps a final question, and no surprise given where we are in this room. I think people are wondering, what can they do? What role does the power, could technology help address some of the pressures you described? Could social entrepreneurs make a difference? What are the kinds of things that people in this room and in this part of the world, what can they do?
Yeah. So I won't give away everything because then you won't buy the book. But to me, as I touched on earlier, I think that people tend to focus on demand side policy interventions. So they'll say things like, oh, we need to have higher taxes on certain cars. And those types of things tend to work really well in developed markets where people are conscious and more sensitive, and they have options. You can choose to buy a Prius versus a gas guzzler. If you're sitting in a place like India or across Africa, many other places in the world, you switch on your tap. It's quite normal in many places that water doesn't come out, or the water that comes out is dirty. That's unheard of in the United States. So I think the sort of things that we'd love to see from the United States, and actually only the United States, I think, can do this effectively, are things in technological space, are things in innovation. We talked about water. Desalination is an enormous problem. But why is it that the leaders in desalination are Saudi Arabia and China? The United States has the ability to do this. My probably most controversial thing that I say in the book is, 2010 military spending in the United States was $700 billion, almost $1 trillion is going towards military spending. A lot of the wars that the U.S. is either engaged in or is policing are wars that are actually resource wars. So if you even take a fraction of that amount of money, use it in Silicon Valley or wherever in California, somewhere in the world, to try and find a solution, whether it's nuclear fission or desalination of water, whatever it might be, to some of these problems, not only would we live in a more peaceful world, but we would solve the resource problems that we're facing today.
On behalf of the Council, please, I ask you to join me in thanking Dambisa for an excellent talk. I'd like to remind everybody that Dambisa's latest book, Winner Take All, is actually available in the room, and if you'd like to purchase it, courtesy of Books Incorporated, and she'll also be available to sign copies of the book here on stage. So if you could stay here for
sure, that's great.
For that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.